London's mosques, has been jailed for life with a minimum term of 40 years. 25-year-old Pavlo Lapshin stabbed Mohammed Salim 3 times as he walked home from evening prayers in Birmingham in April. The Ukrainian had only been in the UK for 5 days. Mr. Salim's son, Shahid, says the sentence is what the family had hoped for.
These crimes were religiously and racially aggravated in nature. We hope this case serves as a deterrent to other terrorists who may plot such acts of horrific violence for the purposes of creating fear and terror in the communities.
A 16-year-old boy who threw acid at a woman has been sentenced to 8 years and 3 months. Tara Quigley suffered horrific burns to her face and body as she answered the door at her home in Romford in East London in April. The 28-year-old had to have 2 skin grafts following the attack by Liam Sibbons. It's been confirmed a young girl taken into care from a Roma couple in Greece is a Bulgarian mother and father. It's after DNA tests on the blonde child known as Maria. The couple, who she was found living with, have been charged with abduction. Firefighters in England and Wales are going on strike the day before bonfire night. They're walking out on November the 1st and 4th for a few hours in a dispute over pensions. The Chancellor says Britain's hard work is paying off as the UK's economy is growing at its fastest pace since 2010. Official figures show gross domestic product grew by 0.8% during the third quarter of this year. George Osborne says more still needs to be done.
The British people, they took some tough decisions to confront our economic problems, and we're beginning to see the benefits of that now. But look, I'm the first to say there's still lots more difficult decisions to be taken, lots of risks out there that remain, and if we want to stay on the path to prosperity, we've got to stick with the plan.
Hundreds of jobs have been saved thanks to a deal to reopen the Grangemouth petrochemical plant. After a long dispute, union leaders have finally accepted a survival plan. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Helping us review this week's news is Labour Councillor for Bedminster Colin Smith. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. With the minimum price for a 3-bedroom house in North London now topping £1 million and prices of property going up 10% in a month, it's becoming ever more difficult for us to get the one thing we really need, a permanent and secure home. The average 3-bedroom house actually costs around £50,000 in man hours and materials to build, so why are we paying way over the odds for our housing? Land is a free gift to mankind, and we've around 65 million acres of it here in Britain, with 65 million people going about their day on top of it. Why can't everyone have at least enough land to live on, and where they don't have to pay rent to anyone? Well, the fact is, some families make a killing by keeping it from us, and have been doing so for centuries. This week we have two of the country's leading experts on land ownership, both of whom write occasionally for the London press, including The Guardian and The New Statesman, to discuss the very question, is Britain still a feudal country? That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 13 Celsius, it's quite warm, isn't it, and some light rain. Highs of 16 through the weekend, fairly cloudy with some sunny spells and some showers and gusty winds Saturday and Sunday. Next week, highs again around 16 Celsius, a fairly sunny week with occasional showers. Next weekend, that's the 2nd and 3rd of November, highs of 13 degrees Celsius, fairly sunny. But the temperatures are slowly dropping, aren't they? That was Bristol's 2-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. On the weekend, we slip out of British summertime, can't you tell? It's going to put the clocks back an hour on Saturday night time. So helping us review this week's news is Labour Councillor for Bedminster, Colin Smith. Hi, Colin, and welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you very much.
First of all, on our question for hour two, is Britain still a feudal country? It'd be interesting to hear from you, as someone who's been Lord Mayor and circulated around a bit amongst the great and the good of Bristol. Is Britain still a feudal country?
I still think that... working people have a lot to do to get back to some kind of influence or power in this country. I think that there are certain influences in this country, class influences and class divisions, which still exist and have been in existence for hundreds of years. and it's difficult to break them down.
Now, I mean, it sounds to me like you're saying, yes, it is. But, I mean, we had a civil war, didn't we, in the 1600s? Still, I mean, what's the situation now? Do you think that some of the gains that have been made by working people, equality, that is to say equality of opportunity around the country, which was certainly sold to us, wasn't it, in the 1950s and 60s, some of that has been lost now?
No, I think that we are gaining incrementally, but it's only bit by bit. I mean, I remember my grandfather was a miner who died at the age of 50 from silicosis. Now, you know, for his grandson to end up as Lord Mayor is probably outside of anybody's imagination. So that indicates that working classes are making steps, but we've still got a long way to go.
What about people like the merchant venturers? Because, I mean, we talk about them here quite a bit on here. I mean, they were involved in the slave trade back in the old days, and many people say, well, that's let bygones be bygones, but they're still very powerful and wealthy today, aren't they?
Well, yeah, absolutely, and clearly it's not just about people who are merchant venturers. It's about people who are investing in business, starting in businesses and succeeding at businesses, which are part and parcel of the mixed economy that we live in. And they have a great measure of influence. But, you know, there's still the ballot box.
And does the ballot box really mean anything still? Because, again, you know, a lot of people now say, well, whoever's in charge of the ship, it's still going the wrong way.
I think the worrying thing about the ballot box is that clearly we have a generation of young people who in 20 years' time are not going to be voting. And that is actually a serious problem for the working class, is that there are people who are leaving school in Hartcliffe today who will not be voting in any local or general election in years to come. And actually what's that doing is giving away power to people who do use power in other ways.
I mean, isn't that because, Colin, they think that actually the vote isn't really going to make much difference to their lives, that most of the main parties are simply, they're all bought in to the same kind of economic system?
Well, to a certain degree, you're correct, but I do think it's about education, and I think it's about educating people to understand the nature of the vote and the need to vote, and what part that vote plays in allowing us all to take part in the power and the administration that we see in throughout the country. I think it's a very, very difficult question.
So what was the biggest lesson you learnt about how Bristol really works from being Lord Mayor?
Biggest lesson I learnt was that there are people within this city, and you have to bear in mind that Bristol is a very wealthy city, but unique amongst other cities in the country, we have lots of people who are at the top end of the economy, and we have lots of people who are at the bottom end of the economy, and actually the two don't meet. And I think that's one of the things that we actually that I actually discovered about how Bristol operates, is that the business and entrepreneurship in Bristol is very how can I put it? They network furiously, and they do fantastic work for their own charities. But essentially, the people run this city for their benefit.
Interesting. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, you're really been proved wrong today, haven't you? We've had a massive, not necessarily massive, but a bit of a leap in growth, and it looks like the economy is starting to pick up.
Well, I've never said that the economy wasn't picking up. Don't forget, we've had wall-to-wall quantitative easing and zero interest rates for several years, and if the economy didn't pick up when you did that, there'd be a problem. But of course, the level of unemployment is creeping down, although there are arguments about what the stats actually show.
No, the level of unemployment is creeping up in this part of the country, Martin. Well, I mean, in fact, generally it is. I mean, the actual number of people employed, for example, is going up.
Yeah, well, the point I'm making is this, is that there was a big surge in unemployment when we had the crash in 2008, and that is not, you know, small reductions now don't really change the fundamentals.
But, I mean, it wasn't, to be fair, it wasn't a crash, was it? It was a financial crisis. Things needed to be refinanced, but it wasn't a crash. Well, a crash was what was avoided.
Yes, but at the same time, it was a crisis. There probably is, this is the point I would also make, is when Bernanke recently talked about ending quantitative easing in the US, the stock markets around the world had a fit. And basically, they can't withdraw from quantitative easing now.
Well, I mean, it looks like the quantitative easing policy is working, doesn't it? Because it's slowly, things are getting back together again. I mean, I know we are apparently now actually not up to the same rates of output that we were back in 2008, but we're getting there, and at least we're heading in the right direction.
Well, that's what George Osborne would say. And that's what he did say.
Well, indeed. And he's quite right.
Let me point this out. If the US Congress had not voted to extend the debt ceiling last week, we would have had a stock market crash last Friday all over the world. And that is the real danger. And nobody in the mainstream political system in this country really wants to tell the people, actually, this is an incredibly dangerous situation. If Wall Street melts down again, as it may well do, at some point, and it's not quite sure what the shock would be if we'd started.
But it's not going to melt down, is it? Come on,
it is.
Let's be realistic. There's too many people with too much at stake to allow something like the Wall Street to. I mean, it's too many very rich and powerful people would lose their money. They're not going to let
it. That's why quantitative. Yes, but you cannot carry on printing money forever. It was supposed to be a stopgap measure to rescue the system. Probably they said we'll be having quantitative easing maybe for 2 months or 6 months. We're now 4 years into it, and at some point the bond market will collapse. It'll happen in a moment. It'll happen in a morning. And what the civil service in this country need to do when that moment comes, whoever's in power, whether it's us or the current shower. When that morning comes, I want to see a plan to go on the table of the Prime Minister.
It's not really fair, you saying this current shower, because it doesn't look like it's going to be collapsing anytime soon. Now it seems like we're over the hump. Now we've got growth up to 0.8%.
This is whistling in the wind. The global economy is on a wing and a prayer. Quantitative easing and 0% interest rates, basically negative interest rates for 5 years, you'd expect a bit of growth. What they've done is they've stuffed the mouths of the speculators with gold, and there's some crumbs are falling from the table, but ultimately this table is built on sand, and at some point this system, there will be a crash.
Well,
absolutely predicted.
Okay, here the Telegraph today is saying the UK confidence is booming as economic growth is set to soar. Optimism amongst UK manufacturers rose last month, the fastest rate since April 2010, according to the CBI.
They can say what they like, and there's no reason why the economy can't grow before the crash. We've got a bubble economy, we've got a housing bubble developing in the southeast of England. Meanwhile, in places like Blackpool, the situation is the same as it's always been. It's the same old. Same old southeast housing bubble stuff from this Tory government. The same stuff we've seen so many times before, and it will hit a brick wall. And when it does, everybody's going to lose their teeth.
Well, it's very, very doom-laden stuff there, Martin.
I'm sorry, it's just a fact. But you can't blow a bubble like this and not have it go. Because it will.
Okay, Colin, what are your thoughts? I mean, it does look like that the Chancellor of the Exchequer, George Osborne's policies are working. Today we hear GDP growth has accelerated up to 0.8%.
Well, I'm not a big expert on national economics, I'm afraid, but what I do know is that there are lots of people in the areas where I live and in Hartcliffe and Southmead and Norwest, etc., who are actually suffering because of the austerity cuts that we're actually finding in the cost of living. And actually there has got to be a better way for those people, and not for just the speculators who are seem to be benefiting from economy.
Are you convinced, as Osborne is, that things are now starting to pick up? He's saying, you know, growth, well, it's not him that's saying this, it's your Office of Budget Responsibility, that growth is now picking up.
I'm not convinced. I think it's still very fragile, and I still think about the impact on ordinary people and their ordinary lives.
Well, this was very much a topic at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday this week at Westminster, and interestingly enough, it was questions to the Prime Minister asked both by Ed Miliband, the Labour leader, and also both parties were asking the same question of the Prime Minister, the Conservative Party second and Ed Miliband first. So let's go now to Wednesday's Prime Minister's Questions about this one, about energy prices.
Hey, Mr. Speaker, John Major said what we all know. We have a Prime Minister who stands up for the energy companies, not hard-pressed families. Many people face a choice this winter between heating and eating. These are the ordinary people of this country who this Prime Minister will never meet and whose lives they will never understand.
The difference is, John Major is a good man. The Right Honourable Gentleman is acting like a con man. That is what we're seeing. He is promising something he knows he can't deliver. He knows he can't deliver because he never delivered it when he was in office.
Mr. Brian Binley.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Thank you. I know the Prime Minister is very well aware of the concerns that many of our people have on rising energy prices. Will he therefore act to reduce the effect of Mr. Hume's unfortunate legacy by cutting the carbon reduction policy, elongating the targets, and relieving the burden on both consumer and businessmen?
Yeah, Minister.
My honourable friend makes a good point, and that's why I say we have to have an honest discussion about this, because the fact is, on our energy bills is £112 of green taxes and green regulations, and we need to work out what is necessary to encourage renewable energy, what is necessary to go on winning overseas investment into the UK, but how we can bear down on people's bills. And it simply is the politics of the con man to pretend that you can freeze prices when you're not in control of global energy prices, but the proper approach is to look at what's driving up bills and deal with it.
Let me just say, I let it go the first time. The word con man is frankly unparliamentary. And let me order. The Prime Minister is a man of great versatility in the use of language. It's a bit below the level. We'll leave it there.
That's the Speaker there intervening because of the use twice of the expression con man to describe Ed Miliband's idea of a price freeze. But the fact of the matter is, these green taxes are actually costing everybody about £100. Isn't it one of the simplest things to do, just to drop this idea of green subsidies, and that will bring our energy bills down?
Well, I mean, frankly, these industries should be in public ownership, and 30 years ago they were. And we wouldn't be talking about this at all. And that's what ordinary people are beginning to realise. We should never have privatised this industry, should we?
Well, it's easy to say that, but surely that's why what Ed Miliband's saying, suggesting a price freeze, is so ridiculous and irrelevant, because actually they don't have control of these companies. These companies can charge whatever they want for their electricity.
Well, I mean,
gas.
John Major was talking about having a windfall tax on them. But the point is, what you do, if you either regulate these kind of utilities or you have them in public ownership. I would argue they should be in public ownership, like in Norway and other sensible countries. But if you're going to regulate them, you regulate them so hard that they can't make a profit, and at that point they give you those industries back, because you've regulated them so hard that they can't make a profit at it, so they then say, oh, sorry government, you can have it back. That's what you should be doing. And if there is a crash, as I suggested that there will be, all sorts of things are going to come onto the table which can't be discussed now, so everybody's just talking in code at this stage.
Now, Labour Councillor for Bedminster, Colin Smith, what's your solution to the problem of rising energy bills? David Cameron is saying get rid of these green subsidies, or green taxes as he calls them, and Ed Miliband's saying that we should have a price freeze. A lot of people think that's unworkable. What do you say?
Well, I mean, I think that the market is broken. I think that when British Gas can generate electricity and then sell it to itself, I understand it makes 15% profits on generating the power, and then somewhere between 5% and 7% on then selling it to us. I think that indicates that the market is broken. Also suggests to me that if you are trying to invite the Chinese in to help us with Hinkley Point, is that the Chinese are there for a purpose, and because Osborne is selling the fact that they can come and cream off our market and exploit the consumers who can do very little about it. And when Cameron says that we should be shopping around, well, who do we shop around in amongst the cartel of the six? In order to get a price which is very different from E.ON to N-Power to EDF.
So what's your
solution? Doesn't work.
What's your solution, Colin?
I don't have a solution. I just think that what we need is, before we can go anywhere, we need to actually to look at closer regulation of the companies and the way that they operate anti-competitively.
Martin, what about this point that Colin's making there about Hinckley bringing the Chinese in? The fascinating thing, of course, being that this is, and there's a great little article, I think it was in The Independent, saying Hinckley Point nuclear power station, a new type of nationalisation. It's right. Okay to nationalise things, but this is actually French and the Chinese taking over our energy supplies. It's not private businesses. These are nationalised, effectively. Yeah.
That's something. This is the Communist Party Central Committee will decide on the pricing policy, I suppose. I mean, that just shows how absurd it is. And they've been offered a 30-year contract with double the current rate that they can get for the market. Now, in other words, they're subsidised to do this. Now, when you're subsidising this, it's like the railways are now getting three times as much in subsidy than they had when they were under public ownership. Now, what we're doing is we're carrying on subsidising things, but we're letting the private profits be taken. How absurd it is for the railways to be three times more subsidised than they were under public ownership, and yet we've got people taking a profit out of that. It's just it's madness.
Isn't the fact of the matter, though, that it's actually going to be completely impossible to take these back into
national ownership? No, it's not. What will happen?
It's going to cost too much. We don't have money to do it.
What will happen? What they do in Venezuela is you carry on regulating. You tighten the regulations, like tightening the screw on you. Tighten the screw, so they can't make any profit. And at that point, they give it you back because they've got nothing else to do with it. Now, these things, what Ed Miliband has done by raising the issue of energy prices and the cost of living is he's moved one inch away from the neoliberal consensus of the last 30 years, and he's getting accused of all sorts. He's being accused of being a Marxist, etc., etc. So is John Major a Marxist in that case. But the point is, most ordinary people, the opinion polls show, they want these utilities and the railways back in public ownership because they can remember, Colin will remember, a time when this was just normal stuff. It was just normal stuff, and everybody just shrugged their shoulders. Yes, these industries are run by the government. It wasn't a big deal. That's how it was.
One of the things I can remember, this is back in the 1970s, I do go back that far, yes, when they went over from town gas to North Sea gas, and you had people from the gas board went round all the houses changing over the nozzles on your gas cooker, that we were told at the time that actually there's so much less investment, a lot of investment needed to get it going, but so much less manpower needed to run the gas board under North Sea gas, that after a few years of us paying our gas bills, they were going to possibly even going to be able to make our gas free back in those days. Now, that's not the case now, is it? It's being jacked up massively. But I put it to you again, Colin. What could you do? I mean, we've heard an answer from Martin. He says more regulation. And is that your idea too, to actually try and bring these bills back under control? Because, I mean, a lot of the materials that this is made from, with the exception of nuclear, things like wind and gas, are actually at the point of delivery that they are actually free, aren't they? I mean, there are companies that can get them out of the ground. It costs them not nowhere near as much as they're selling it to us. They're making a massive profit.
But that's why we've got to look at the market. That's why we've got to look at the way that the infrastructure of the energy companies, and look at the way that they are actually charging us, the consumer, to use this energy, and the way that they're exploiting us. And the fact is that energy bills are rising beyond the means of a lot of people, which is why we're now finding that people are going to food banks, because it's either, as the famous John Major said, it's heat or eat.
Now, before we leave the subject of the utilities, another question at Prime Minister's Questions this week was from Wales. It was about Welsh Water, which is run not for profit, according to Roger Williams.
Mr. Roger Williams!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister will be aware of the business model of Welsh Water Dew Cymru, which is a not-for-profit company responsible to its consumers and not to its shareholders. Does the Prime Minister agree that such a company in the energy supply sector would introduce real competition?
Yeah. Prime Minister.
Well, we want more competition in the energy sector, whether that comes from private businesses, whether it comes from cooperative businesses, or, as he says, charitable enterprises. We want an open energy market, and the fact is what we were left was the Big Six, a six left to us by the party opposite. We're also left an Ofgem where the leader of the opposition had appointed five of the nine people. The reason the energy market isn't working properly lies largely at his door.
Well, that's an interesting point he's made there, Colin, that actually the current setup, which is really not working, and I mean, he's Prime Minister himself is saying we need more competition, was actually set up by Labour.
Oh, I don't think so. I mean, I think that's an absolute myth because, I mean, if you're old enough to remember Margaret Thatcher, I mean, I remember SWEB and I remember MANWEB and I remember all of those organisations.
These are the old nationalised boards.
Absolutely. And they seem to operate reasonably effectively without being fixed. So actually it was the Tories that set this whole thing up, and of course what they do is when they set anything like this up, they set it so that it can't be restored back to default. And that's what we're now suffering is that they've set it up. And if you read some of the stuff like I read today, they're now stuffing the Ministry of Energy or Department for Energy with people being seconded from the energy companies to help them with their policy.
Well,
so,
that's right.
You know,
it's often the revolving doors, isn't it? They go both ways. They go from the Department of Energy into the big energy companies and back the other way as well. Martin?
The main conceptual problem here is people talking about competition. We need more competition, and even the Labour front bench are saying we need more competition. I mean, that Labour MP was saying. Now the fact is that these industries, because of the technology involved, are not this kind of infrastructural industry is not competitive. You can't run it as a competitive industry. That's why they were nationalised, because they are natural monopolies. Yeah, how many gas pipes do you have running into your house?
One.
Yes. So that's the problem, and it's to do with the physical nature of what you're producing. So all of these people saying let's get more competition in. If you've got six companies in an industry, even if you had seven or eight, it wouldn't make any difference, because it's all chapter three of your economics textbooks. Oligopolies rig prices by default. They always do. That's how those markets work. It was never a competitive market in the first place. It wasn't suitable for being put in the private sector. It was put in the private sector by the Conservatives with no default. You couldn't go back to fix it. And that is why we've... I mean, just think of our small companies, our small and medium enterprises trying to export into the international market. They're paying above the odds for their energy, so that profiteers in the city can make a few bob, but that actually undermines their export capacity. So in other words, Britain has basically shot itself in the foot with both barrels. And of course what the new Labour era did, they didn't reverse any of this. But if there is another crash, I'll come back to that one, all these things are going to come back on the table.
Okay, well, we'll see if there is. And now we're looking at low pay. It was an excellent Dispatches on Monday evening about low pay, and it was referred to by Andy Sawford at Prime Minister's Questions.
Mr. Andy Sawford.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The realities of work for millions of people, low pay, short time, 0 hours, agency exploitation, were exposed on Channel 4 Dispatches this week. Did the Prime Minister see it? If not, will he use catch-up so that he can watch it and then wake up to real life in Britain?
Everyone in our country wants to see living standards increase, more people in work, and for people to keep more take-home pay. And that is why we have cut taxes for the typical working person by £705 when you look at what will come in place by next year. Let me make the point about zero-hours contracts, which is this. The proportion of people in employment on 0 hours in 2012 was the same as it was in the year 2000. The number of people in employment on 0 hours increased by 75% between 2004 and 2009. That is when that lot were in government.
Well, he's talking there about more take-home pay, Colin, but one of the things we saw on the programme was people who are finding large amounts of their pay actually going to agencies as just a simple payment fee, £15 a week, for example, just being taken off of your paycheck for no apparent reason. And a lot of people also being put onto, often through agencies, very unreliable contracts where they really don't know if they're going to be employed 1 week to the next.
Well, I just think it's pernicious and iniquitous, and that it shows that the economy that we've currently got is unbalanced, and actually we should be creating more jobs, more permanent jobs, through and paying a living wage, not just a minimum wage.
How have you seen employment conditions change over the years?
Well, I mean, I think that certainly when I first entered the world of work, it was a situation where there were jobs for everybody. and you know, the wages clearly differed between all jobs. I mean, I don't think we have that security anymore. And actually, you know, we look at our own children and actually encourage them to try and find a job, any job, whether it be part-time, whether it be agency, whether it be 0 hours or whatever. And that's the difficulty that our younger people and older people are now finding, is that there is no security in the market at all. And we're storing up things for later on when, God forbid, we're going to have a pension crisis in 30 or 40 years' time, when many of the people who are entering the world of work now will have nothing. They will leave work with nothing.
Martin, one of the other things that was on the dispatches programme was the sort of consultants that will waft into a business and they'll say, well, you know, the contracts that you're putting these people on are really rather too secure. If you change things around, jiggle things around and get them to sign these new contracts, you can sack them much more easily, pay them less and all this kind of thing. Now, these consultants are making a fortune.
Well, that's exactly what's happened up at Grangemouth, isn't it? The unions have had to accept complete rewriting of wages and conditions. Now, what's happened in the last 30 years, from 1945 until 1973 in the Western world, real wages rose. Productivity rises pretty automatically in a capitalist system. The capitalist system is quite good at inventing new ways of doing things. It's a very good system for, you know, inventing new gadgets, new work processes, and normally you'd expect productivity to rise in a capitalist economy by about 3% a year. And in the past, because of strong trade unions, particularly in places like Scandinavia, but also in Britain, that productivity increase was passed on as wage increases. So you saw real wages rising year by year from 1945 to 1973. And I remember, I grew up in the 60s. I remember we got our first black and white television. Then we got a car. Then we got a colour television. And everybody knew that we were going forward and people's wages were rising. And that actually is that's the way to run it efficiently. But since 1973, in America and Britain in particular, that link has been completely broken. So now real wages can be forced down. That's why unemployment hasn't rocketed as it did in the 80s. It's because the bosses are able to force real wages down, which they never used to be able to do, but they can do it now at the drop of a hat. They've just done it at Grangemouth. But of course, what that does is it undermines. There's no demand in the economy, so everything gets all the money, the profits are then reinvested in more speculative activity and not reinvested in productive.
So you're
activity.
Saying that because the workforce isn't being paid enough, people aren't spending enough in the economy.
That's right, and ultimately you solve that problem by putting people into debt. So youngsters today, they go to university and come out with 30 grand of debt, and then if they're lucky, they get a job and get into the housing ladder and take on another load of debt. And so by the time they're 25, they're several hundred grand in debt. And they've got to do that because they haven't got any choice. It's not like, oh, they shouldn't have gone into debt. What else are they supposed to do?
But Colin, don't you think young people are going to look at your generation, point to you and say, how on earth did you hand a legacy onto us of so much unemployment and debt? I mean, particularly for young people who are now wanting to study, they're going into the workplace where they may not get a job and they've got a debt before they've even begun.
Well, I think the problem, much of the problem is that certainly when I was at in further education, that you know, I was a relatively small percentage of people who actually went and then came out of university with some sort of qualification, and then we moved into a job. Now, clearly, the figures in terms of education and academic education, 50% of people of young people are going into further education and then coming out you know, to find that there is no employment, and the other thing that has happened over the years is we've lost our manufacturing industries. We've lost the sorts of skills and knowledge and expertise that was prevalent when I was young, and so that those industries are have been shipped abroad.
Martin, much of the growth that was announced today, this 0.8% of growth, is in the service sector. Yep. How do we fix the system so that we actually can provide enough, or even, perish the thought, even more than enough jobs, particularly for youngsters as they're coming out of college and university? Well, surely all of them should be able to go to work.
Well, yes. I think we're never going to go back to a full employment economy of the kind we saw between 1945 and 1973. But I think we are moving forward in the sense that in Cyprus and in Switzerland and also in where's the other place? Oh, in Italy, demands are now being made for what they call a citizen's income, and this is something the Greens have been talking about for 20, 30 years. Basically, you pay everybody a basic wage just for being a citizen, and you could link it, for example, to participation in elections. So if you go to the election and show that you voted in the last election for anybody, or even spoilt your ballot, then you get your citizen's income. And that replaces things like unemployment benefit, mortgage tax relief, which the middle class get, and all the rest of it. You have to completely revamp the system. And then, of course, there's no benefit trap. If you get 1 hour's work, you just get 1 hour's work. If you get 40 hours work, you get 40 hours work. Nobody can complain because everybody gets it. Yeah. So the top people will hardly notice the two grand or one and a half grand a month that they're going to get. It'll be a tax rebate for them. They wouldn't even notice it. Now, these demands are starting to come forward in Southern Europe, because we're never going back to a full employment economy. But what are we going to do? Just let everybody starve? No, we've got to rethink how the world of work, share out what work exists, for example, 3 day weeks and all the rest of it. I know it sounds utopian, but a crisis is an opportunity to start talking about what you really want to do. That's what crises are for.
Okay, well, one of the effects of the austerity crisis, if we can call it that, is that maternity discrimination tribunals now cost £1,200 because of the taking away of legal aid. And the question was asked by Diana Johnson at Prime Minister's Questions this week about this.
Diana Johnson.
Mr. Speaker, does the Prime Minister think it's fair that a sacked pregnant woman will now have to pay £1,200 to take a maternity discrimination case to the Employment Tribunal?
It's very important people have access to employment tribunals, and they do under this government. The one thing we have done is make sure that people don't earn those rights until they've worked for a business for 2 years. I think that's the right approach.
Not quite sure about the answer there, Colin Smith, Labour councillor for Bedminster. Your take on that, because it is quite a lot of money, isn't it, to pay just to question whether your employer was right or wrong sacking you while you were pregnant, and you may lose it all.
Well, I think this is one example of the pernicious measures that this particular government is actually taking against working people by denying those same working people the right to some form of justice or some form of hearing within the tribunals. And they've done it by cutting off things like legal aid, by employment tribunals, and actually denying access to justice by ordinary working people who can't afford to have solicitors and to shell out £1,200.
Martin?
Well, yes, I mean, it's this whole idea of attacking people's wages and conditions as a solution to a crisis is wrong-headed. You need to actually start from the position that we actually want people to be healthy, well-fed, well-paid, happy in what they're doing. I mean, and work backwards from that. You know, decide what sort of society you'd like and then work backwards from that. And that they're not. You can't cut your way out of a crisis. You just can't. And incidentally, lots of people in work are still taking benefits as working tax credit and so on. So we're actually subsidising companies to pay low wages. Now, if we're going to subsidise half the population, let's subsidise them properly and be honest about it. And of course, there's no reason why the people at the top should be paid as much as they are. I mean, in Japan, for example, the people at the top are paid something like 10 or 12 times what the shop floor's paid. In this country, it's 40 or 50 times. In America, it's hundreds of times more. And there's no justification for it, none whatsoever. After the Second World War, they knew very well that if you want a capitalist economy to work effectively, you've got to redistribute. And everybody recognised that. You have a capitalist economy, some people get rich, some people are poor, but you always redistribute. It's like an infant's party. Everybody must go home with a prize. And we always used to know that, but now we don't.
Well, one big change we've heard about this week is the Co-op Bank. They're in trouble. Hedge funds are circling the bank. There's a hedge fund called Silverpoint, which was set up by Goldman Sachs. Debt trading tycoons Edward Mule and Robert O'Shea. It looks like the Co-op's in trouble. Retail and hedge fund holders of Co-op Bank's $1.3 billion of bonds have forced it to change its recapitalisation plan, potentially wresting control from the parent Co-op Group. This is a major climb down by the group's new chief executive, Ewan Sutherland, and the bank's new bank's new chief executive, Niall Booker. Co-op Bank also revealed that it found a further £100 million to £105 million of extra provision needed to cover payment protection mis-selling, bad debts and breaches of the Consumer Credit Act. Said this had been notified to the Prudential Regulatory Authority. Now, nothing's quite certain about this yet, Colin, but it looks like the Co-op Bank could have to float on the stock exchange and become a bank just like any other bank. It's now being taken over by this Goldman Sachs hedge fund.
But don't you think that's part of where we are with the institution of banks, is that the old co-op mantras of being, you know, sharing amongst its own shareholders in terms of running a bank, is that I'm afraid that that ship has moved on, and that the previous apparent incompetence in running that co-op bank is now coming home to roost. And clearly they need to look at the way that they are operating in that particular part of the finance sector.
I know KPMG had a role in advising the Co-op Bank whether or not to take on these new Lloyds branches, a big deal which fell through, and also a merger with the Britannia Building Society. I mean, is what Colin's saying true there, you think, that really the Co-op Bank is a kind of dinosaur bank from another era?
No. What they shouldn't have done is take over the Britannia Building Society and take on the Lloyds branches, but they were encouraged to do that by the government, because the government was they were talking about more competition in the sector.
By George Osborne particularly.
Yes. Now, in actual fact, what we probably need to do is what they've got in North Dakota is what they call the Bank of North Dakota, which is owned by the state of North Dakota.
It's another socialist solution, is it?
Well, it was set up by a farmers' movement in the early part of the last century, the 1900s, because they were fed up of borrowing from Wall Street and being ruined and so on. So they set up their own bank owned by the state of North Dakota, which is actually a Republican state and quite conservative. But they are the only state in the Union which is today solvent, because they've got their own bank. And why shouldn't we have, for example, a national bank of Britain to compete with the private banks? And you know why we don't have that? Because the private banks wouldn't be able to compete with it. It would wipe them out. And ultimately, you might end up with having one lot of utilities owned by the government and one banking system also owned by the government. And you know what? That's where we're going in the end.
Well, we shall see. And now on to Plebgate. If the police are allowed to lie and cheat, we're heading for anarchy. This is Peter Oborne in the Daily Telegraph. When the allegations against Andrew Mitchell were first made, he's saying, "My sympathies were entirely with the police. I frequently witnessed shatteringly rude or overbearing conduct by senior politicians towards minor functionaries. This kind of behaviour, which amounts to abuse of power, is completely detestable. There seemed little reason to disbelieve police claims that Mr Mitchell had behaved in the way that they described. There was certainly no reason why a cabinet minister should be exempt from the consequences. When David Cameron finally sacked him, my only criticism was that the Prime Minister had been rather too slow to take action." And he says then, he goes on to say, "It is now clear that I, along with many others, owe Mr Mitchell an apology." What are your thoughts about this, Colin? I mean, we've got a government minister who's resigned, effectively being sacked, actually, the chief whip of the Conservative Party, and the Police Federation representatives who were in the meeting with him came out of the meeting and said he didn't give us an account of events. Actually, Andrew Mitchell was recording it, and he clearly did give them an account of
it. I think it's a very complex affair, and I don't think we've actually heard everything, every detail about it yet. I mean, it seems certainly to swing from one side to another in terms of Andrew Mitchell's resignation, and then subsequent evidence that suggested that the police briefing of the media wasn't as accurate as they might have suggested. But I think it's something that unfortunately, we used to regard the police as being somewhat friendly to the Tory party and the Tory government, and I actually think that it's coming back to bite them up the backside, frankly.
But isn't it, I mean, it certainly looks like it's the case that the police here are annoyed with the Conservative Party because they're cutting the police, and then they're actually putting the boot in a metaphorical fashion.
Absolutely.
Martin? Yeah.
Well, I think what's interesting about this is whether he used the word, it all hangs on whether he used the word plebs or not, because he admitted that he told them to F off. Now, if I, as a citizen, told the police to F off, I could expect to have my
car
filled.
No, I don't think he did, actually.
No, he did. He said he admitted, he swore at them. Yeah, he swore at them. He used the F word. Now, maybe that's okay. Maybe if you're a football hooligan, you can do that. But if you're a football hooligan, you might be nicked for using the F word to a copper. And if you're a Tory cabinet minister, you might get nicked as well. And I think he resigned. He had to resign because he swore at the police. That's good enough for me. You should just shut up and put up.
Okay. Well, we'll see how this one rumbles on. Now, we've also, picking up on last week's, we did a special report on the death of Michael Hastings, the US journalist who had been exposing the fact that the US Central Intelligence Agency and the Pentagon were starting to spy on politicians. It sounds almost like an echo of the Edward Snowden revelations that have been going on, rumbling on through the year. But what he was saying is that the John Brennan, who's the new director of the Central Intelligence Agency, was starting to use his information operations units and parts of the Central Intelligence Agency actually to spy, not on foreign powers, but actually on his own politicians, the echoes of Watergate. And not only that, but also to tap the phones of investigative journalists and actually to actively work to stop investigative journalists doing their job. Last weekend I came across quite an interesting report from DARPA, Defense Advanced Projects Agency, I think it's called, the people who helped develop the internet in the United States, the defense research people, who were talking about how easy it is, frighteningly easy it is, to tap into and to hack a motor car which has got a computer on board. So let's have a listen now to the killer car hackers quotes from Kathleen Fisher from DARPANET.
The importance of improving computer security. As Dan just alluded to, though, it's not just traditional computers that we need to worry about. There are many other kinds of systems as well. The slide that's been omitted showed a result of the researchers at UCSD and the University of Washington hacking into the dashboard display of a typical American sedan, making it show that the car was going 140 miles an hour while in park. Drilling down a little bit, modern vehicles consist of between 30 and 100 embedded control units, which are essentially small computers connected via a CAN bus. These cars are required by law to have a diagnostic port, typically located under the steering wheel, that allows mechanics to download diagnostic information and to perform software updates. In a first paper, the researchers from UCSD and the University of Washington showed that if they could touch the CAN bus through that diagnostic port, they could take over all of the functionality of the car that's controlled by software. And in a modern automobile, that's pretty much everything. The brakes are controlled by software because of anti-lock braking. The acceleration is controlled by software because of cruise control. And in those fancy new cars that can park themselves, even the steering is under software control. The reaction to this first paper was somewhat muted, perhaps because if the researchers had access to that diagnostic port, they were inside the car, and so already had physical access to the brakes, acceleration, and steering. They responded with a second paper in which they showed a variety of ways of touching that CAN bus without physically touching the car. These attacks involved infecting the computers in the repair shop and then having that infection spread to the car through the diagnostic port, or hacking in through the Bluetooth system, or using the cell phone network to break in through the telematics unit that's normally used to provide roadside assistance. The most ingenious attack, though, used the stereo system in the car. The researchers were able to craft an electronic version of a song that played just fine in your home stereo system or on your personal computer. But when you put that on a CD and played it in the car CD player, it took over total control of your automobile. Yeah, right. Pretty scary, huh? These vulnerabilities arise because the cyber components that form the interface of these cars are built from the same kinds of buggy components that are in your personal computers. And the control systems that are actually running the car have no notion that there can be an attacker sitting on the CAN bus.
Well, that's Kathleen Fisher there, a very smart lady from DARPA in the United States, Defense Advanced Research Projects. Colin, I don't know if you've got a modern car, have you? But did you realize that there could be a virus at your car servicing place when they plug it into your car? It could actually put a virus on your car computer?
Absolutely not, but I don't have cruise control either, so I think I'm the one who's controlling the acceleration.
So the idea really here is that actually actually the older your car is, sometimes the better it is, and actually possibly the more safe.
Well, quite right too, because I mean clearly the modern electronics on any vehicle must be capable of being hacked. I mean, I only read earlier today about Dick Cheney's pacemaker being changed because the security people in Washington thought he could be killed by somebody sending some sort of signal to it. So With increasing electronics, it's going to happen.
Hacking into pretty much everything. Dick Cheney's pacemaker, modern cars. Martin, what can we do about this? I mean, that most amazing thing I think she was talking about there, in a way, was a CD that you put on to play in your car, and without you realising, it's sending a virus right into the heart of your car's computer.
Well, let's come back to the sharp news end of this. Michael Hastings was a investigative journalist in the US. He spoke to his friends a couple of days before he died, saying, I'm worried about driving my car. I'm about to make a big story.
Well, actually,
about
it was the night he died. Yeah, he went to see a friend, yeah.
I'm about to make a big story about the FBI, CIA, and John Brennan, who's the head of the CIA, and I'm really worried that they're going to do something to me. And then his car, which was a new car, a Mercedes, with all of this electronics, was seen driving at full speed into a tree, wasn't it? And, of course, the videos show that he was banging the brake. The brake lights were on, but he was doing 90 miles an hour, and he hit the tree. Now the suspicion is that he's been murdered by somebody hacking the car. So that's what we're talking about here. It's that, and of course, if people are prepared to do that, then they can do it. That's quite obvious. You could used to snip brake cables, didn't they? Things like that. You can mess. But the thing about, I used to have a Morris Minor years ago, my first car, and the thing about those is they're designed to be fixed by the owner. Everything can be taken out, put back in. It's like a Kalashnikov rifle. It's just basic kit. But of course, everything now has got a black box in that you can't touch. There's a friend of mine saying that there was driving on the motorway, and he's got a hire van, and suddenly the van with the computer said, you've got to do 30 miles an hour on the inside lane. And it's just, I want to go faster. This is a motorway. So he had to pull over and stop. The AA came out and said, there's nothing we can do about it. It's the computer. So they had to put the thing on the back of the van and take it away. The more complex a system is, the more possibilities for breakdown exist, and that includes financial systems and cars.
One other quite complex system, it seems, is that the way that the local Labour Party around here selects its new candidates, Colin, because we've had a prominent Labour councillor in the city's huge regret this week at the party resignation. A prominent Labour councillor decided with huge personal regret to resign from the party, says the Bristol Post. Derek Pickup for Hartcliffe said he resigned due to the actions of a small number of people within the wider Bristol Labour Party. Mr Pickup is the councillor in charge of Bristol's education department, formerly, will continue as an independent councillor until his term of office ends in May next year. He will not contest his seat. It's understood that he failed to be accepted by a panel set up by the party to approve prospective candidates who want to be re-elected or to become a councillor. So how does that work in the Labour Party around here? I mean, it probably is similar to the other parties, but it's one of those sort of mysterious things that we don't necessarily know how the parties do this. How do they select candidates for MPs and councillors?
Well, I can only tell you how they select candidates for councillors are people have to appear before a panel to get onto the list to be an accredited candidate, and certainly the process is a very robust procedure in order for us to end up with good quality and highly competent councillors, as Derek was. I in fact wrote to Derek the other day saying, in fact, I'd know a good councillor when I see one, and he is one. And he was a valued member of the Labour group, and for his own personal reasons, he's decided that he can no longer be a member of the Labour Party. And I thank him for what he's done for us over the years. But in terms of the process, there is a robust process in order for us to have good quality candidates and good quality councillors.
Well, you say it's robust, but I mean, if it's in the hands of just a handful of people, not in the hands of the party as a whole, it puts a lot of power in those individuals' hands,
well,
doesn't it?
It's not in the hands of just a few people. It's in the hands of the party generally, and there are a large number of people who are active within the party who may not be candidates or even councillors,
but you don't
who are
select,
part
you don't
of the process.
Select, you don't select candidates, do you? I mean, Martin, you're a Labour Party member. You don't select candidates either. It's a small panel of people.
Well, yes, I mean, I must admit, I'm mystified by this. I don't really know what it's about. Yeah. I mean, I remember back in the 70s, we used to threaten people with deselection if we felt that they were, you know, not sticking to their principles and what have you. And, of course, that caused a lot of rows, and it was a very, you know, if you remember the era, there was a lot of broken crockery. And in a way, the fact that it's more, you know, there's less at stake these days is actually better. But I do wonder what's happened here. I mean, There must be some politics behind it. There must be some reason for it. I don't know what it is.
I am not party to what went on in that room, and I'm not party to the arguments that were made, and I'm not party to the explanation other than the one that Derek offered. And I understand he was on Radio Bristol earlier in the week offering his thoughts on the matter. But I do think that any party that is going to put forward candidates for the local authority to be councillors, which is a very responsible and sometimes, dare I say, powerful position to be in, they have to be accredited against the party's principles and against the party's rules and against the party's policies.
By this small panel. Who is the panel?
Well, the panel varies between, is drawn from a pool of people who are activists. But I can tell you one thing is that councillors do not interview other councillors. So in fact, if I was a sitting councillor and I was seeking re-selection, I would not be interviewed by my colleagues, so, simply to make the process more independent and more robust.
Martin, you've said that you don't really know how this process works. Is it a good idea to have three individual Labour Party members, or four, or however many are on this panel, making these decisions without them being made to a wider group of people? Because obviously, Derek's not happy with it. We've just heard from Colin; he thinks he's a good councillor.
I dispute what you say about Derek's not being happy with it. I mean, Derek actually has over the years accepted the principle that if you are going to put up as a candidate, that you are going to subject yourself to a selection process. Now, I don't know what went on at Derek's last interview, but certainly the process has been in place for some years.
Well, I know a little bit about it, and that is that he was faced with a lot of unsubstantiated allegations against him, why the panel decided that he shouldn't become a candidate. But you've said you thought he was a very good councillor.
He is a very good councillor, and I'm sure that he's going to play his part in the council chamber until May. But the fact remains is that the selection process has been there for some time. It's not just three individual people who attend all the selection panels. It's a number of people drawn not only from the Bristol Labour Party, but from other parts of the South West as well.
Okay, so it's something maybe to do with the sort of district Labour Party. But how is it decided who goes on these panels?
Candidates are invited to come forward.
Martin, do you think this is a satisfactory system?
Well, to be honest with you, I've been a member of the Labour Party since 1975, and I've long ago given up the idea of it as a democratic structure. I'm a member of the Labour Party like people used to be members of the Communist Party. It's because it's the place to get things done. And I basically accept that I'm not going to have much of a say in it. I'll say what I think. And I don't get involved in all of this, and by not getting involved in it, I don't have to have a strong opinion about it either way. I think there is a question in my mind: if somebody is a sitting councillor and they've been representing a ward for a long time, you've got to have a pretty good case to remove them and put somebody new in.
Colin,
got to obey the rules, whatever they are.
Colin, just give us an idea of why you think that Derek is a valuable... what's he contributed to the city?
Well, Derek is probably one of the hardest working members when he was a member of the Labour group. Invariably, you would find him out on the pounding the streets on a Saturday morning, not only in his own ward, but right across the city.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. We've got the Murdoch News at 6 now. Up after the news, land reform. Thanks very much to our guest, Colin Smith from the Labour Group, and he's the councillor for Bedminster.
Online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, a Ukrainian student's been ordered to spend at least 40 years in prison for trying to start a race war in the West Midlands.